there's a catch. Because the flow of blood is much slower than the firing of neurons, an fMRI can't show how the brain operates in real time. It can only tell us what brain areas might be involved in a given task. The holy grail for brain researchers has been to place electrodes right inside the brain. That would allow them to know both where a signal originated and also precisely when it was generated. But to conduct such a measurement, neuroscientists would have to find subjects willing to, well, have electrodes placed inside their heads. And even if they were able to recruit volunteers, the invasive surgery required to implant electrodes would carry a non-trivial risk of permanent brain damage. Ethics boards would never allow it. Fortunately, there's a clever solution that is providing exactly what researchers have been hoping for. Accompanied by a neurosurgeon, Hoy enters what appears to be a typical hospital room with a bed, a couple of chairs, and a few family visiting members. Occasionally, a member of the hospital staff enters the room to monitor vital signs and any changes in the patient's condition. But the patient is wearing something you wouldn't normally see in a hospital room, what at first looks like a large turban. On closer inspection, it becomes clear that there are wires protruding from the headpiece, and those wires are connected to a nearby machine. Hoy, armed with a stack of legal paperwork, asks the patient whether she's still willing to participate in the study. She agrees, and Hoy begins his work. The young woman suffers from epilepsy, and her seizures have been so frequent and troubling that the doctors have decided the risks of surgery are worth the potential benefits of understanding where the seizures are generated and, in turn, what can be done to stop them. The patient is recovering from an operation that took place just yesterday to place electrodes in her brain, not for purposes of Hoy's laboratory or research, but to treat her epilepsy. Cases like this provide Hoy access to individuals with electrodes already placed inside their brains. Weighing the risks to the patients and the benefits to science as a whole, ethical boards have granted neuropsychologists access to these epilepsy patients, provided that they adhere to certain rules and limitations. Neuropsychologists began by asking the patients to solve puzzles or complete other game-like tasks. This allowed them to isolate precisely which parts of the brain are activated when we make a given type of decision. Over time, they noticed that whenever a participant made a mistake, an immediate electrical signal appeared. We're talking about a tenth of a second after the error was committed, explained Hoy. That means that before we even have time to consciously realize that we've made a mistake, let alone consider its ramifications, our brain has already gone on high alert. Neuroscientists soon realized that the error signals weren't really associated with mistakes per se, but more generally with surprises. Whenever reality failed to match the patient's expectation, the signal would go off. Have you ever had that awkward sensation of putting your foot forward to walk down a step, but in reality there's no step there? Your foot falls awkwardly on the flat surface as your balance readjusts and you realize you anticipated a step where none was. Or how about reaching for a glass of wine while looking the other way, but grasping nothing because someone has moved the glass? In both instances, the error signal would fire in your brain. Looking into the matter further, neuroscientists discovered that these error signals are generated by specific parts of the brain that are dedicated to noticing anomalies. Let's call these regions surprise neurons. Rather than sift through the massive amount of data coming in about what's going on around you, considering each piece and what it means, your brain simply goes about its business, relying on the surprise neurons to raise the alarm when something unexpected happens. It's a very efficient approach. And your brain reacts sharply to surprises. When something happens that catches you off guard, you immediately course correct and almost instantly shift your core assumptions to better navigate the environment. Now, what works for the brain also works for organizations. They just need to identify and engage their own surprise neurons. If the glove doesn't fit. The Albert Einstein Medical Center in Philadelphia is representative of many large businesses. It has a vast patient pool, a limited budget, and various units that can't always communicate with one another. For years, the hospital, like many others around the country, has been plagued by a germ that is responsible for more yearly deaths in the United States than HIV/AIDS. Antibiotic-resistant staph infection, MRSA, has been on a steady rise, and your best bet for picking it up is to spend time in a hospital. But unlike other deadly germs, MRSA spreads in a way that's completely preventable. We've known exactly how to avoid it since the late 1800s. Health professionals need only wash their hands before seeing each patient and consistently wear protective gloves and gowns. There are a million reasons, though, why even the best doctors fail to gown up. It's not that they don't recognize the importance of being safe. Small factors just get in the way. The Albert Einstein Center, seeing rising rates of preventable patient deaths due to MRSA, decided to take action. Rather than just printing informational pamphlets about importance of hygienic practices, the hospital's head of infection control assembled a selection of staff members representative of all levels and all roles, from surgeons to janitors. During the session, a man named Jasper, a high school dropout and Vietnam veteran whose job was to transport patients between rooms and to empty the trash, raised his hand. The astute observation he was about to make would become a literal lifesaver. "I've noticed," he began, "that in the wing with a lot of MRSA infections, the garbage cans are always nearly empty. They don't have any gloves in them." Trying to solve the riddle of what was going on, the group went to that unit and asked the nurses why they weren't using gloves. It turned out that the nurses in that particular wing all happened to have very small hands, but because the hospital stocked equal numbers of each glove size, the extra small gloves would always run out before the rest. Larger sizes were cumbersome and made simple tasks awkward and difficult, so the nurses were often going without. "Would you wear gloves if we stocked more extra smalls?" asked the head of infection control. "Of course we would," replied the nurses. Jasper then took out a Sharpie and wrote down his phone number so that every time the unit ran low on extra small gloves, they could simply pick up the phone, and within minutes Jasper would provide a refill. It was incremental change like this that lowered patient mortality by 70% in 1 year. Now, this is not to say that the whole hospital should have been stocked with more extra small gloves, nor should the janitor have been promoted to head of infection control. Rather, using the neuron analogy, the janitor in this case happened to be the key surprise neuron, the one guy who saw the garbage bags with enough frequency that he was able to notice the anomaly. A surgeon might have passed the garbage cans dozens of times without ever picking up on the anomaly, and including him in the conversation allowed the brain, hospital administration, to receive his message. We can use such organizational neurons to avoid the pitfalls of bad intel within our organizations. We need to have as many Jaspers around us as possible, people who will notice and be surprised by different things than we will, and we need to delegate to them the task of being surprised. Reflect for a moment about the kind of processes and procedures that organizations utilize to prevent surprises. Vast amounts of money are spent to ensure that managers get even the most minute details, but a manager sifting through a mountain of information may not be very well positioned to notice small but crucial anomalies. Virtually no company has in place a dragnet similar to that of the human brain to pick up on surprises in various levels and corners of the organization. But imagine for a moment you're the CEO of a large organization, and you're able to learn about anything unusual right when it happens, not by sifting through all the facts yourself, but by surrounding yourself with the right people and making sure the anomalies they notice get conveyed to you. you would have the opportunity to address each surprise with intention and change the company's course of action to better navigate the business environment. Think about how much more effective you would be than the CEO of your competitor, who may have all the facts at his fingertips but rarely learns about the surprises occurring within his organization. Can organizations create a process akin to our brain's response to surprise? Overcome the ACE. Unfortunately, it's not sufficient to merely surround ourselves with as many organizational surprise neurons as possible. We need to create both mechanisms to encourage them to sound the surprise alarm and systems to attune ourselves to the signal when it comes.
In the workshops he runs,
Ori often runs an exercise in which each participant randomly picks from a shuffled deck of playing cards, but isn't allowed to look at which card they drew. Once everyone has a card in hand, Ori counts to three, and they all lift their respective cards to their foreheads, so you can see everyone else's card and everyone can see yours, but you don't know what card you hold. He next tells the participants to pretend they're at a company picnic where the ace represents the CEO, the king is the VP, and so on, down to the twos, which are the lowest. The task is for everyone to interact with one another, giving clues as to the other person's standing in the fictional company. Over the years, he's heard people give heavy-handed clues.
Hey, are you staying at the Motel 6?
Nudge, nudge, wink, wink. So now he cautions them against being too obvious. He's also had senior leaders, people who are in charge of thousands of people, intentionally walk by mirrors so that they can sneak a peek at the cards on their foreheads. So he's had to start covering up mirrors during the exercise. Apparently, we all want to know where we stand. As they mill around, Ori reminds the participants to keep meeting other people. After a few minutes of this, he asks them to line up, without talking or looking at their cards, in rank order. Without fail, the group nails it. The threes line up ahead of the twos, the jacks right above the tens but below the queens. You'd think military folks, accustomed to a rigid rank system, would be exceptional at this task, but CEOs are just as good at it. So are nonprofit managers, social activists, and UC Berkeley students. Still, when he tells participants they can finally look at their cards, they're surprised by how quickly they each knew their place on the ladder. No matter our age, profession, or industry, as humans, we're highly sensitive to status. What was your first hint that you were a two? Ori asked a manager recently. Well, for starters, no one looked at me. No one came to talk to me. And the people who did come and say hi told me to keep doing a good job. Conversely, every single time he runs the exercise, the ace knows his or her status right away. People call the ace sir or ma'am. They don't interrupt when the ace is speaking. They laugh at the ace's stupid jokes. When Ori ran the exercise in his undergraduate business class, sure enough, the students knew exactly where they stood in the arbitrary made-up social ladder. In this specific instance, two of the most popular women in the class, smart, motivated, bright, friendly, drew twos. They stood chatting in one corner as the ace entertained the king and queen in another corner. "Did the ace ever come up to you?" he asked the twos. "Of course not." "Did you ever go up to the ace?" "No," said one of the twos. "But it's not like you were shy. I saw you walking up to another two. What were you talking about?" Without missing a beat, she responded, "We were talking about how this party sucked." Now, it's easy to understand why the twos weren't having a good time. Who wants to be at the bottom of the totem pole? And it's equally easy to understand why they wouldn't be going over to announce their displeasure to the ace. But here's what is really fairly shocking. When Ori asked the ace what he'd been talking about with his fellow royalty, he said, "We were chatting about how fun this, made up, remember, picnic was." The ace had no idea that the twos weren't having a good time. From a two's perspective, every incentive is to keep quiet. You don't want to alienate the ace. At best, maybe you'll be patronized. And who wants that? If you're an ace, no one below you is going to tell you that there's a problem. You can be the nicest, friendliest person, but because you have an ace on your forehead, everyone else's incentive is to lie to you. How many times have you met a leader who thinks they're beloved by their people, but then you speak to their direct reports and learn that the initiatives put forth by the leader are a complete mess? It's not that these leaders are out of touch. It's just that they are blinded by being the ace. In the chapters to come, we look at specific tools, leadership principles, and instincts that actually foster inclusion. This isn't a philosophy. It's an ongoing practice to stay attuned to the knowledge that so easily gets withheld or ignored. Chapter 5. The Power of Belonging. Historical Roots. Since the 1940s, a sense of belonging has been recognized as a human psychological need and one of the major sources of human motivation. It's important to us, whether we're conscious of it or not. A sense of belonging keeps us healthy and happy. Belongingness developed to serve an evolutionary need. Those who formed mutual attachments to others enjoyed the safety of numbers and were less likely to wander off alone into danger. Anthropologists have suggested that it was humans' ability to form and comprehend more complex vocal sounds, the rudiments of language and the foundation of our identity as a social species, that enabled us to survive, ultimately outlasting our hominid neighbors like the Neanderthals, Denisovans, and Homo floresiensis. Footnote, Mitch Prinstein, Popular People Live Longer, New York Times, June 1, 2017. As social beings, we protected one another, shared resources, and collaborated to gain advantages over other species. Though deeply rooted in basic survival in a very different world, the need to belong hasn't faded over time. Today and millennia ago, belongingness consists of the combination of a sense of identity, how we distinguish ourselves from others, a sense of security, the opposite of powerlessness, and a sense of order, structure and predictability. Belonging can be a pretty vague term. That is, we all know what it means to belong to something, but it's hard to distinguish levels of belonging. What does it actually mean to be included? You may be a member of an airline's frequent flyer program, so in a sense, you belong. But that level of belonging is much less significant than, say, being a member of a church or of a team at work. Theoretically, we could ask individuals how much belonging they feel toward an organization or a cause, but doing so would at best yield approximate qualitative data. Thus, for our purposes here, let's set a high bar for what we mean by belonging. The highest such bar is being willing to set aside your individual interests in order to advance the interests of the group. Think of a mother, for example, willing to go hungry so her kids can eat. Think of a soldier who risks his or her life for comrades and country. Psychologically, we do so not just out of altruism, but because of a belief that by advancing the cause of the group, we advance our own narrative. As humans, belonging to a family unit ensures our survival. Our family members' willingness to sacrifice for us, should we need their help, provides us security and safety. There are multiple reasons why people may feel connected. We see these as, 1, feeling that your efforts on behalf of the group are meaningful. 2, being able to imagine how your contribution will have a meaningful impact. 3, receiving rapid feedback about the impact you've had. 4, having positive memories associated with belonging. 5, feeling invited to belong, as opposed to ordered. And 6, engaging within a context whereby you are a part of the overall group narrative. The development of industrial society raised fears that we were losing our sense of community, that the faceless, anonymous sprawl of the world's cities was depriving us of the basic ability to feel as though we are part of something bigger than ourselves. And in the 1980s, researchers began studying belonging and have unequivocally come to the realization that it is, in fact, a need. Without it, humans suffer both mentally and physically. The science behind it. In an effort to understand how we experience belonging and exclusion, some researchers have focused on the anterior angulate cortex, or ACC, the part of the brain that becomes active when we experience physical pain. One study aimed to find out if the ACC would become active when individuals experienced rejection. Footnote: Naomi I. Eisenberger, Matthew D. Lieberman, and Kipling D. Williams, Does Rejection Hurt? An fMRI Study of Social Exclusion, Science 302, number 5643, October 10, 2003, pages 290 to 292. fMRI images were captured while participants played a virtual ball-tossing game with two other players. They were told that the other players were fellow study participants, also in fMRI machines. In actuality, the other players were part of a computer program. At the beginning of the game, participants were told that due to technical difficulties, the links to the other players' machines couldn't be made, so the participant would have to watch the other two play before joining in. Researchers observed that when test subjects were arbitrarily left out of the game, the ACC did in fact become active. The results of the study suggest that the feeling of rejection has a similar effect on the human brain to that of physical pain. Social exclusion can also hinder our thinking and cognitive processes. In one study, participants scored significantly lower on IQ tests and other cognitive tasks after experiencing rejection, even just being told that they were likely to end up alone in life or be socially excluded at the time of their death, affected their ability to process and act intelligently. Footnote: Roy F. Baumeister, Jean M. Twenge, and Christopher K. Nuss, Effects of Social Exclusion on Cognitive Processes, Anticipated Aloneness Reduces Intelligent Thought, Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, 83, No. 4, 2002, pages 817 to 827. So what happens when people actually do live lonely lives? In a meta-analysis of 148 studies, with a total of over 308,000 participants aged between 6 and 92 from all over the world, psychologist Julianne Holt Lundstedt of Brigham Young University made a surprising discovery. The size of a person's network, their number of friends, whether they live alone, and whether they participate in social activities are predictive of that person's lifespan. Footnote: Julianne Holt Lundstedt, Timothy B. Smith, and J. Bradley Layton, Social Relationships and Mortality Risk, A Meta-Analytic Review, PLOS Medicine 7, No. 7, July 27, 2010. People with larger networks, who have good quality relationships, have a remarkably increased chance of survival over time. In fact, the results of the analysis demonstrate that social exclusion is more harmful to us than obesity, physical inactivity, and binge drinking. The only comparable health hazard? Smoking. Low social connectedness not only is a predictor of natural life expectancy, but also is a significant predictor of suicide attempt. Footnote: Toru Takizawa et al., Stress Buffering Effects of Social Support on Depressive Symptoms in Middle Age, Reciprocity and Community Mental Health, Psychiatry and Clinical Neurosciences 60, No. 6, December 2006, pages 652 to 661. A 1994 study on social integration demonstrated a near-perfect correlation between family growth activity, marriage, lack of divorce, birth rates, and homicide rates. Footnote, Gene M. Twenge et al. If you can't join them, beat them. Effects of Social Exclusion on Aggressive Behavior. Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, 81, number 6, 2001, pages 1058 to 1069. What is the link between a lack of connections and self-destructive or violent behavior? When we experience social exclusion, we perceive our lives as less meaningful. Footnote. Tyler F. Stillman et al. Alone and Without Purpose, Life Loses Meaning Following Social Exclusion. Journal of Experimental Social Psychology, 45, number 4, July 2009. Pages 686 to 694. Being excluded by our families, close friends, and romantic partners has the greatest effect. Footnote, Twenge et al. If you can't join them, beat them. And just as social exclusion is correlated with a less meaningful life, a sense of belonging is strongly positively correlated with perceived meaningfulness of life. This is true across age groups. Footnote. Nathaniel M. Lambert et al. To belong is to matter. Sense of belonging enhances meaning in life. Personality and Social Psychology Bulletin 39, number 11, 2013, pages 1418 to 1427. But when compared with older adults, those aged 18 to 24 report feeling very differently from adults in other age groups in terms of their relationship to belongingness. In a 2007 comprehensive study conducted in the United Kingdom, this youngest group of adults reported feeling they didn't belong to any one group and that they believed their sense of belonging would not always be rooted in the same people, places, and beliefs. Footnote. Social Issues Research Center. Belonging. Research commissioned by the Automobile Association, July 2007. This stands in contrast to their older counterparts, who reported feeling a sense of belonging to a single group that was less likely to change. Those in the 18 to 24-year-old age group were more likely to feel that their sense of belonging came from a wide variety and number of groups that was constantly changing. In the workplace, they found it nearly twice as easy to leave their jobs as those over 24. Have young people always felt this way about belongingness? As a result of factors related to age or life stage? Or has the landscape of belongingness changed, altering the experience of social belongingness for this group? We argue that though people may feel more rooted the older they get, the change in the social fabric of today's society has made belongingness a little more complicated, especially for young people whose experience is dominated by the digital world. The new context. In the past, our sense of belonging was rigidly defined in terms of traditional markers of social identity, our families, close friendships, lifestyle choices, nationalities, professional identities, and hobbies. Think back to the pre-digitized era, when our network connections were limited to those in our immediate geographic areas, at best stretched to include the occasional pen pal. Today, for the first time in human history, via the Internet, people are able to create their own geographically dispersed belonging categories. We can seek and find groups whose members could be anywhere across the globe, and the complexity and size of these new networks give what is now labeled globalization a peculiar force in influencing belonging. The vast world of social networks, from the vast to the niche, has become ubiquitous in our lives. They exist not only in addition to our jobs, our personal lives, and our hobbies and communities, but also as a medium through which we participate in our workplaces, our friendship circles, and our geographical communities. Social networks have broken down communication barriers by simplifying the exchange of information among friends, co-workers, and strangers alike, thus allowing culture to spread and influence the information around us. Not only are those members who are born into a culture able to be a part of it, but outsiders who are interested in it can also learn about it, join it, and celebrate it. Social media networks are now markers of our social identities, a part of everything we do, and they are giving us power we've never before experienced. Though mass media has always had the ability to shape public opinion, the Internet has put this power into the hands of every user. Simply by participating in a social media network, an individual has the ability to start a movement, become a leader, and gain a following. YouTube is now the world's largest mass communication medium, allowing each and every person to create content and spread a message across the world. Social networking sites like YouTube empower us to learn, to participate, to lead, and to follow groups and communities we may never before have been able to connect with. Where we once had barriers to engaging with individuals and groups all over the world, these walls no longer exist. We can start groups and seek them out in order to be included, no matter where, no matter when. Facebook and Twitter are no strangers to the idea that social networking sites have a place in the world of belongingness. In fact, they emphasize that achieving a sense of belonging comes from engaging in the ongoing, real-time flow of digital self-expression. Facebook urges you to connect with friends and the world around you by participating in your personal news feed. Twitter tells you to find out what's happening right now with the people and organizations you care about. The positive messaging holds up. Studies have demonstrated that the Internet environment is very supportive of friendships, romances, volunteerism, fundraising, and every variety of support group an individual might seek out. In fact, the Internet is particularly welcoming to certain kinds of support groups, those whose members feel stigmatized by society and are reluctant to share their concerns with their home networks through personal and public discourse. A well-known example of a stigmatized group finding support and strength in numbers via the Internet is the It Gets Better Project, launched by Dan Savage and Terry Miller in 2010 in response to rising suicide rates among LGBT teens. A video created by Savage and Miller went viral, and more than 50,000 more videos like it from people of all races and creeds across the world were added to the movement. But it has long been argued that while the Internet, along with the mobile devices we carry to access it, offers perpetual human contact and access to groups worldwide, it's conducive, ironically, to independent mobility, fleeting social connections, and self-promotion. Prompts in your Facebook news feed, "How are you feeling?" emojis that share your mood with one click, and suggestions to add posts about life events promote a hyper-preoccupation with the self. The sheer variety of tools available to us to broadcast our personal information suggests we should consume ourselves and our network connections with this information. But as you broadcast your personal information, are you truly being heard? Is there a real connection? And do you really belong to a mutual group? Even if you do feel a sense of belonging to that group online, are you likely to feel and behave as you would if the group existed in the real world? The short answer is no. Research has shown that the predictable ways in which we operate as individuals in groups play out entirely differently online. Footnote: Patricia Wallace, The Psychology of the Internet, 2nd edition, New York, Cambridge University Press, 2016. Researchers have been surprised by how quickly and easily people become disinhibited when socializing online versus in a real-life context. When compared with traditional group behavior, People engage in aversive social behavior in the digital world extremely easily. Aversive social behavior in the group setting is puzzling. These kinds of behaviors threaten a person's belongingness to a group. Who wants to hang out with the bully? But aversive social behaviors are sometimes performed in order to amplify belongingness. People engage in these behaviors in order to influence and control others. The result in many cases is that the individual feels empowered or energized. But why does this happen so much more easily and frequently in the digital context? Researchers argue that due to the invisible nature of online interactions, there is less incentive to act in socially appropriate ways. Footnote: Social Issues Research Center. Belonging. Imagine that a selection of 50 dog owners from across the United States are all put together in one room with instructions to remain silent and still. If we were tasked with entering the room and writing down every bit of information we could about this group in 1 minute, what might we jot down? Well, we would likely first mention the piece of information we've already been given, that everyone in the room owns a dog. Next, we could determine a number of other pieces of information through basic observation, such as that the group includes both men and women. We might see a wide range in age, from a high school student to a grade retiree. We could point out that there are individuals of different races, different heights, different hair colors, and different sizes. We might notice that some are fashionable, some have facial hair, some wear glasses, and some are physically disabled. In a short amount of time, we would be able to draw a lot of information about the personal characteristics of the members of the group without their speaking or communicating in any way. But let's take that same group, leave them in their homes in front of their computers, and put them in an online forum. When we enter the forum, all we see is a list of usernames and possibly a small photo selected by each individual that may or may not include the person's face, body, or self in any way. Now, what can we write down about them? Our list would likely be shortened to just a couple of facts: that they are all dog owners, and perhaps that the group is of mixed gender. Personal characteristics would be virtually absent. SIDE, S-I-D-E, Social Identity Model of De-Individuation Effects, theory, explains what happens when personal characteristics are obscured or invisible, as they are in anonymous online groups. Rather than focus on the characteristics of the individual, members of the group double down on a common social identity. Research suggests that in online groups, individuals feel stronger attachment to the group's identity than to their own personal identities. In fact, personal identity is all but erased due to the lack of nonverbal cues highlighting individual differences. Footnote: Wallace, Psychology of the Internet, pages 20 to 21. This makes for an extremely cohesive in-group, one that suppresses individuality and magnifies the differences between the in-group and outsiders. There are obvious implications for online communities espousing extremist views of any stripe. So, while Facebook and Twitter are driving users to focus on their individual experience online, that experience is becoming more and more about the groups to which the individual belongs. What can we do as leaders for our teams and their personal senses of belonging? Why should we care? The human desire to belong holds a key to understanding how to lead in our current environment. As we discover a sense of belonging to a team, organization, cause, or community, we find that our goals are in line with those of the group and with those of the leaders and other members of our team. With our combined efforts aligned and everyone working toward a common goal, we find a sense of control that produces a sense of order for each of us within the organization, and this trickles into our individual daily lives. Where we have order, we have predictability. Predictability in our actions and the actions of those around us. It is this predictability that allows leaders to take the actions necessary to build and uphold the vision of the organization. Feeling that we matter to our organization and are safe within it reaffirms and strengthens our sense of belonging. When people feel they belong, they engage more and are more productive. Belonging helps us achieve understanding, and the feeling that we understand those around us and that they understand us strengthens the positive bonds among the members of the team and its leaders and enhances our feelings of self-worth. Belonging has relevance not only for individual well-being, but also for the organization. By bringing the right people into a meeting, task, or job at the right time for a particular purpose, you can build a sense of individual purpose while successfully utilizing your resources to achieve your goals. Belonging also serves leaders in their mission to establish a sense of positive conformity within the organization. When we belong, we tend to adopt the attitudes and behaviors of those around us. When people lack a sense of belonging, they instinctively seek it in unhealthy ways that may be destructive to your organization. In short, a lack of belonging within an organization not only results in negativity and ineffectiveness, but also opens the door for team members to find the sense of belonging they so desperately need in competing or unhealthy causes, which can be damaging to individuals and catastrophic for organizations. In the new environment, the true sense of belonging we used to gain from our communities isn't as prevalent. For some, it may not exist at all. Simultaneously, endless pathways to belonging are available to us via technology, social media, and the ubiquitous flow of information they offer. In a world where people are not readily feeling as if they belong to a positive cause, and where everyone has the ability to belong to something, we need to help our team members make good decisions regarding the efforts with which they choose to identify. If leaders fail to provide this for their subordinates, these people will find belonging for themselves in ways that will be decidedly unhelpful in our effort to produce order and shape the outcomes of our actions. As the sense of true belonging seems to erode around us, we as leaders must create real and authentic ways for our subordinates to feel that they are a part of something meaningful. We must create environments wherein individuals feel they are the first among equals. As leaders, we must commit a certain amount of every day, every month, and every year to ensuring that people feel a sense of belonging in our organizations. Part 3. The Inclusive Leader. Chapter 6. Belonging isn't optional. Leadership Principle Number 1. Give them memories. Leaders are busy. Most would say that they have more to do and less time to do it than ever before. It's probably true. After all, leaders still have to do the things they have always been expected to do, but with the added challenge of managing exponentially more information and competing with digital echoes for the attention, trust, and confidence of their followers. Leaders have always had to compete for the trust and confidence of their followers. However, that competition has become more intense and more important in the era of digital echoes. It's actually pretty simple. If people don't feel like they belong to your group, department, company, or corporation, they easily can and probably will find something else to believe in and belong to. The most important responsibility of leaders, no matter how busy they are and how many other priorities demand their attention, is to make their people feel like they belong. Opportunities to make our followers feel they belong are all around us. Opportunities to give them memories, so that they know we care about them by investing in them our scarcest resource, time. Leaders have to develop an instinct for communicating a sense of belonging to their followers and then be alert for opportunities to do so. A private word in the hallway. A compliment at a meeting. The willingness to listen for just a few minutes beyond our usual attention span. The habit of explaining in a constructive way how some paper, proposal, or briefing could have been done better. Beginning conversations with an inquiry about the well-being of the person or their family. A handwritten note to express condolences, congratulations, or appreciation. An unexpected phone call or unannounced visit. Producing memories of success, memories of failure, reinforcing a feeling of commitment and belonging. Give them memories, or someone else will. It was 1975, and young Lieutenant Dempsey, officer in charge of a remote German outpost 5 miles from the Iron Curtain, wasn't fond of surprises. There was an ever-present fear that an escalation in conflict might suddenly take the cold out of the Cold War. If the Soviets decided to invade West Germany through Czechoslovakia, this small military installation was the first line of defense. The camp looked exactly how you would picture a frontline military base in the middle of a German forest. The 800-yard square perimeter was surrounded by chain-link fence topped with barbed wire. 6 metal Quonset huts served as administrative offices and living quarters. When a sergeant approached Dempsey to let him know there was an unannounced guest at the gate, Dempsey's radar went up. Such a surprise, he knew, could mean trouble. As it turned out, this was a very unusual sort of surprise. Waiting at the perimeter of the base, the sergeant told him, was not an enemy, but a nun.
"What did you say, Sergeant?"
Dempsey wanted to make sure he'd heard correctly. "A nun, sir." Dempsey was curious. He wanted to ask the sergeant how a nun had made it to the remote base when the nearest village was more than 10 miles away. But his practical side prevailed. He was monitoring a patrol maneuvering along the border, and he didn't want to be distracted. "Tell her I'm really busy. Ask her to come back another time." 5 minutes later, the sergeant was back. The nun was not going to leave until she got to talk to Dempsey. Maybe it really is a nun, he thought, recalling the persistence of the nuns who had taught him in grammar school in Bayonne, New Jersey. Out of some combination of curiosity and caution, what would his mother say if he disrespected a nun, Dempsey decided to make an appearance. Sure enough, standing at the gate was a petite, elderly woman dressed in a black habit. She eagerly greeted Dempsey. She confidently introduced herself. "Hello, Lieutenant. I'm Sister Mary Cecilia. I'm from Milwaukee, but recently arrived over here as part of a mission in Konnersruth," she said, naming a small German village about 10 kilometers away. "One of the other sisters in the convent told me about this small group of Americans in the middle of the forest. I'd come to pray with your soldiers. Today is Sunday, you know." She said it in the same casual way that housekeeping personnel at a hotel announce through your door that they've come to clean your room. Caught off guard and unaccustomed to taking orders from those in any uniform other than that of the U.S. Army, at least since grammar school, Dempsey politely turned her away. She agreed to leave, declining the offer of a ride back to the convent, but only after noting that she would be back for another visit on a future Sunday and expected Dempsey to allow her into the camp. Sure enough, exactly 2 weeks later, the nun once again appeared at the base. This time, though, having gained some assurances that she was in fact who she said she was, Dempsey allowed her to enter. Without missing a beat, she walked briskly toward the basketball court, where a group of Dempsey's most unruly and least disciplined soldiers were in the midst of an intense game. "Where are you going?" Dempsey hurried along behind her, trying to avert an impending disaster. He could only imagine the soldiers' reaction to a nun interfering with their game. "I'm going over to that group of soldiers right there," Sister Mary Cecilia announced nonchalantly. "Sister," Dempsey said with a note of caution, "that particular group of soldiers can be kind of rough, and they're not going to appreciate you interrupting their game." Dempsey wasn't exaggerating. This particular group of men were disgruntled draftees from a very difficult period in the Army's history, including several who were awaiting judicial punishment and discharge for charges involving drugs, racism, and violence. Imagine the look on these tough soldiers' faces when, right in the middle of the game, a nun appeared out of nowhere and announced, "I'm here to pray with you, young men." The scene was so surreal that they didn't know how to react. They glanced at each other with a mix of confusion and impatience, looking for cues about how to respond, then looked at Dempsey contemptuously as if to say, "I can't believe you brought her here." Of course, the basketball players had no way of knowing that Dempsey was just as perplexed by the nun as they were. But now he faced a dilemma. He could throw the nun under the bus, shrug his shoulders, and allow the soldiers to continue their game, or he could defend the nun and absorb the anger that would be directed his way. Dempsey took the middle ground, introducing the nun and telling the men they could pray with her if they wished, but assuring them that it was their choice. Whether they were caught off guard or there was some divine intervention, the men stopped their game and prayed with the nun. After the brief prayer, she asked them about themselves and their families. The soldiers were warm and open, each sharing his story, feeling that the nun genuinely wanted to know about them. After her time with the group on the basketball court, she made the rounds of the camp, meeting with groups of soldiers until dark. At the end of the day, as Dempsey was seeing her off, this time she accepted the offer of a ride, the nun had one more surprise in store for him. She had a question. "Why didn't you want me to talk to those soldiers at the basketball court earlier today?" She wasn't afraid to be straightforward. Dempsey answered her diplomatically. "A few of them aren't my best soldiers." "But they're still your soldiers, right?" she countered, not really caring that she might be upsetting her host. "Yes, of course." "Why do you ask?" Dempsey tried not to sound defensive.
"Well, have you given up on them?"
"Of course not," he objected, realizing immediately that the nun might have picked up on something he had missed. Perhaps he had lost a bit of faith in some of his soldiers.
"That's good," she reflected. "You should never give up on people."
Dempsey bid Sister Mary Cecilia farewell and immersed himself in deep thought. Had he really lost faith in some of his followers? From that day forward, he resolved never to give up on his soldiers. If they had the courage to commit to serving their country, Dempsey would match their service and commitment by serving them. Over the years, there were soldiers who gave up on the Army and failed to embrace the military ethos, and they had to go. But Dempsey would not be the first one to quit. He would make sure each soldier under his influence felt that he or she was part of the team, that he or she belonged. Years later, in 1998, as Colonel Dempsey was giving up command of the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment at Fort Carson, a tall, thin master sergeant, the second highest enlisted rank in the Army, came through the receiving line to congratulate him. "Hello, sir. Do you remember me?" Dempsey remembered his face, but couldn't remember where they had served together in what was at that point his 24th year of military service. "I'm Greg Vincent from back in the 2nd Cavalry in 1975. You were my platoon leader." Greg Vincent, one of the soldiers on the basketball court when Sister Mary Cecilia made her appearance at the border camp. "Hello, Master Sergeant. I see you've done quite well for yourself. Congratulations." "You too, sir. And thanks for giving me a second chance. I know I wasn't the best soldier back in those days."
"No thanks necessary, Greg. We all learned a lot during those days. I'm proud of you."
Dempsey shook his hand and he walked away. As for Sister Mary Cecilia, she became a favorite at the camp. When they weren't on border duty, some of the soldiers would even travel with their wives to visit her from time to time. Dempsey stayed in touch with her for over 20 years until she passed away. He never forgot what she had done for each and every one of the soldiers with whom she prayed.
leave them with fond memories of peace, of being heard, and of being valued. Providing team members with a sense of belonging is an admirable goal, but as a leader, you may find yourself asking how exactly you can accomplish that. Following the principle, give them memories, is a tangible, practical way to create a sense of belonging within your organization. Give them memories is the ongoing practice of providing your subordinates with meaningful experiences from which they will learn and that they will carry with them into the future. The effective leader will set the stage for his or her subordinates to build memories around a breadth of experiences, both positive and negative. The kinds of experiences a leader should provide include successes. Every team member should have memories of what success looks like, how the team accomplished its goal, how the individual himself contributed to that goal, how accomplishing the goal served the higher purpose of the organization, what it felt like to be successful as an individual, what it felt like to be successful as a team, and what it felt like to contribute to the success of the organization. Failures. Everyone should also have memories of what failure looks like, what the team did wrong, or what it could have done better to achieve the goal, how the individual himself could have acted differently to change the outcome, what effect the failure had on the overall goals of the organization, and the feelings one must manage in the face of failure. Being cared for. At the core of belonging are a sense of purpose and a sense of safety. When we show our followers that we care about them as individuals and as contributors to our teams, we reinforce the strength of their sense of belonging to the organization. What right looks like. Doing the right thing isn't always easy. Leaders need to provide their team members with opportunities to learn how to decide what is the right thing to do and carry out those actions, even when doing so is the more difficult route. Your subordinates will walk away with a memory that teaches them a valuable lesson and helps guide their individual moral compasses. What wrong looks like. Mistakes are bound to happen, and these are often the best learning opportunities. An effective leader presents his or her team with situations where it will be easy to do the wrong thing. Coping with the stress and other feelings associated with realizing the wrong thing was done will not only teach your followers valuable moral lessons, but will provide them with the experience and tools to cope with future losses and failures. By following the principle, give them memories, a leader takes the first step in building the genuine sense of belonging that is imperative to the success of the organization. These memories motivate your subordinates to contribute to the vision and efforts of the team. Memories help to inspire and nurture in each individual a genuine commitment to follow the leader in his or her mission to serve the purpose of the organization. To give them memories is to provide your people with the experiences, lessons, and tools they need in order to make a positive impact on the group and its operations. Chapter 7. Connect effort with meaning. Leadership principle number 2. Make it matter. The movie Saving Private Ryan takes place during the initial days of the Normandy invasion in June 1944. It is a tale of unimaginable courage and leadership under the harshest of conditions. A school teacher before being drafted, Captain John Miller and 9 of his men survive the horrors of the landing on Omaha Beach and are sent to find Private Ryan, a soldier who has landed behind enemy lines with the 101st Air Assault Division and the sole surviving son of a mother who has just lost her other 3 sons in combat within days of each other. Captain Miller's men are perplexed, and a few are angry that they must risk their lives for this anonymous soldier, but under his leadership, they successfully find Private Ryan and bring him to safety, at great cost. There is a powerful scene at the end of Saving Private Ryan in which Captain John Miller, dying of his wounds and having lost 8 of his 9 men on the mission to find Private Ryan, whispers to Private Ryan, "Earn this." Captain Miller is telling Private Ryan to make their sacrifices matter. We all want to believe that what we do matters. That's true.